Welcome back to Film Music Focus. Today we have the immense pleasure of composer John Debney, who, as you all know, is not only one of the most prolific composers in the industry, but he's also managed to survive nearly 40 years of this industry, which is no small feat. And it is such a pleasure to have you here, Mr. Debney. Welcome. How are you today?
I'm good, Justin. How are you? I'm probably like you. You know, I'm growing a little bit of the beard.
Yeah.
The hair's long, no haircut. But anyway, it's all great. It's all good. And it's just great to be with you today.
It's a departure from kind of the norm. These last 6 weeks have been, a kind way of saying it's just bizarre. You know, at minimum, it's been bizarre.
Yeah, it's bizarre. And, you know, I've been lucky enough and fortunate enough to sort of be working through this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And so we were laughing about it today, you know, when things come back, as we know they will,
right?
You know, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of excitement and I'll be the first one to celebrate, but you know, I've been just working kind of 24/7. So I think when we do get back to a normal,
yeah,
it'll be a little, you know, won't be as exciting for me, because I'll just be back at work.
Yeah.
But again, I'm really fortunate, because a lot of people are hurting out there, and I'm just, you know, so fortunate and grateful to be working on a couple of projects.
Great. Well, we will be excited to see what the next few things coming out with you are. I've spent years. I mean, I guess the first time I heard your music was in my second year of high school. So I was a sophomore in high school, and it was an eye opener for me for that particular film that I watched, which we'll get to in a moment. The Cutthroat Island. That was in, I think, 95, which was my sophomore year in high school. And so, hearing that swashbuckling swagger, you know, from the music and certainly the accompanying visuals, it was refreshing to hear at that very young age, at age 15, that tradition, that Errol Flynn tradition, is still well and alive, as I thought to myself in 1995. And you know, it's been so many decades already after, and we still all follow so much of what you put out there. And that the topic of output, you know, I think is one that perhaps we can talk a bit more as we progress here today. But sure. No small feat, as I said at the beginning of the episode here, the sheer output and just the ability to survive and reinvent yourself as an artist in this industry. Why don't we start just a little bit with that? Because I think that's an important element to keep in mind for young artists that are either starting out in this industry or already are in this industry.
Well, sure. Well, thank you for those kind words. You know, Cutthroat Island, I was probably about 33 or 34, not sure, right in there somewhere. And it was a kind of fluke that I received the gift of doing that film, because Rennie Harlan, the director, had heard some of my music unbeknownst to me. And that's the way that one came in. And I think he was looking for somebody that, you know, could do orchestral, sort of traditional orchestral music. And, you know, I was a young kid. I was like your age. So it was a big, huge bonanza of, you know, of a gift of riches, of great riches, to be able to, you know, just dream big and just write the biggest music I could write. By then I was a seasoned composer, pretty much. I had done a lot of television and a lot of theme park kind of scores that enabled me to have a pretty cool traditional orchestral reel. And I guess that's why Rennie was sort of drawn to it. And we became good friends, and we had to kind of do it quickly. And then all of a sudden we were in London, you know, with the LSO, with a 100-piece orchestra at Air Studios. And with a lot of sessions. We did a lot of sessions, like 2.5 hours, 3 hours of music ish. And, we had a big choir, and it was just a dream come true. Yeah. And it's kind of a blur, but it was somebody, I remember at the time, somebody had mentioned that, J.W. John Williams was perhaps around, you would know this actually, Justin, was he around 34, 35 when he did Star Wars, the first one?
He was 45 years old when 1977 came along, yeah.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, then he was older than I was, but there was some, in my own mind, I guess I compared, that I had done this sort of rather major, swashbuckling score at a time when I was a young guy. So I could have the time wrong. I don't know if it's 34 or I was 36 ish, somewhere around there, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, this one, I the main title, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the main title is in A minor. And then we go to D. Yeah, I mean, right there, it's just, it pivots. And the way it's orchestrated, and I talk a lot about this with some of the programs that we share through Cine Concerts, and that is that what you hear on the piano, this is kind of two things. If it sounds pretty good on the piano, when I say pretty good, that's a wide range of opinion. It can sound pretty good in the orchestra if you know how to orchestrate it properly. And this idea of taking something even some, and what do you do with that? And you made it so heroic through the orchestration, through the tempi, and certainly the way it was married to the visuals. And right away in this film, you're given a great sense of adventure. So you mentioned television before you got to here. Let's pivot backwards just a couple of years. I think 1993, which was one of my favorite television shows at the time, Sequest DSV, which I guess is also known as Sequest 2032, which I didn't know until recently. Is that right?
Here's the thing. It was just Sequest when I took it over. Now that was a period of time where I was having such fun. I was doing things for Steven Spielberg, that being one of them.
Right.
I'd done a pilot for Steven called The Class of 61, which was a Civil War thing.
Right, yeah.
And that never, it didn't sell, but nonetheless, we sort of developed a friendship, a relationship. And so when Sequest came along, he called me for that. And so I did do the first year and a half, like the first season, part of the second season. And then because of these films, I was so fortunate enough to start getting film work. So I had to, sort of jump off Sequest to do Cutthroat Island and I think Hocus Pocus somewhere around there.
Right.
But yeah, it was just a blur of a wonderful time for me. I was just so, I don't know why, Justin, we're all, sometimes it's luck and fate and, you have to be prepared for the, the opportunities, but that was a really fun time. I'd been married, a few years. We had kids on the way. Yeah. I had three boys. And so it was just kind of a great, creative, crazy time. Sequest, the next iteration, it became a little bit different show with different producers, and I was gone from it by then. I think my friend Don Davis took over for a little bit,
right,
and another chap took over after that, but fun days.
Let's take a look at an interesting choice it might be called for Cutthroat Island, but I love this little tiny scene because of where you decided to stop the music. And I think that there's a lesson to be learned here about not trying to overshadow perhaps what's going on the screen. And one of the other reasons I love this little tiny scene is because it arguably might be one of the biggest explosions in, movie history, even all these years later with CGI.
Jump.
at minimum, there's entertainment value watching that explosion over and over and over. But I think there is a lesson there in where you stop the music. And that was obviously a very intentional point that either came from, I don't know, just a spotting session initially or a trial and error with you and your director. But that's a very impactful moment, perhaps even more so because where you decided not to put music.
Well, honestly, I think that piece of music was quite long.
And was it?
We did it in a few sections, and I think honestly, to be honest, I think I convinced Rennie Harlan to let me get out of music because I said, there's no way, Rennie, you're going to hear this. You're not going to hear music through that explosion.
Yeah.
And he listened to me, which was very cool.
Yeah.
And there was another place in the movie, I remember we did that too, where there was a big storm at sea and, you know, I knew you weren't going to hear much music at one point. And so we did take the music out. But that's, you know, that scene with the explosion, I sort of had to play into it and then let the explosion be the the coda or the period on it. So that's what that was about.
Well,
I convinced them, I think, to take out the music there, which I thought was good.
Well, that's part of the process, you know, and the collaborative spirit with which exists, and certainly you're no stranger to it because you wouldn't be as successful as you've been over these decades unless you understood how to manage collaborative challenges. And you know, I think that's something that is worth talking about, maybe perhaps just for a moment. Is well, you know, it's, you can have a great trusting relationship with someone, but there's going to be a creative rub to some degree, which is good. It makes it for a good you know.
Well, it does, and I don't know why we could do a whole class on collaboration and how that works. And, but honestly, I guess my personality is such is that I don't know, there's something funny about me. Like I love to hear other ideas. I love to collaborate, you know, and some people I guess like it better than others, but I love to hear what's in a filmmaker's mind and I love to get in their mind if I can, he or she, and sort of try to figure out the puzzle that is a film score. So, you know, I've never been one, we as composers or any artists have to deal with people that have opinions, good, bad, ugly, you know, indifferent. And I don't know, there's something about me where I can get perhaps beat down, you know, and then get a good night's sleep and get up and I'm kind of raring to go. And my friend, Bruce Broughton, the wonderful, illustrious, our friend, Bruce Broughton.
Yeah.
Used to call me I think he still does. Calls me the Ever Ready Bunny. You know.
I didn't know that. That's funny.
That sounds like Bruce. Because he just goes, how do you, you know, we've done a few things together and it's always a joy working with him. And sometimes he'll turn to me and go, you're like the Ever Ready Bunny. He dubbed me that years ago, and I love it. It's sort of endearing to me, like, you know, like where he's sort of he's done with it, and I'm sort of, well, let's go, Bruce, let's do it again, you know. So it's kind of wild like that, but I think it's all kind of a personality thing. Oops, hold on one sec, I lost you. Okay, I'm back. I think it's who you are as a person. It's sort of how you navigate. You must do the same thing, Justin. You deal with all kinds of orchestras and ensembles you know, the political scene of it all, and you have to navigate it, and you have to kind of you know, let it slide off your back and kind of go, okay, you know.
Yeah, it's true.
For whatever reason, I guess I have that knack, and I'm glad I have it, because I probably, you know, would have quit a long time ago. Kiddingly, I love what I do, but you know what I'm saying.
I do. And you know, it's an interesting maturation process that comes along with having to deal with that, you know, both emotionally, psychologically, just as a human being. And you know, I think it's worth kind of pointing out that the more and more you do of it, obviously the better you could potentially get at it. But I recall, even just for me 20 years ago, I mean, I had a really rather nasty experience with a young director at the time. And it was one of those moments where, you know, I'm sure you can relate to something along these lines, but he, you know, was berating me in front of the orchestra, literally on the stage, came and interrupted the red light and starts yelling at me about...
That's not okay.
No, well, no. And certainly at the age of 20, I didn't know what to do. And finally, I just kind of decided to burn the bridge. And he was, you know, screaming about how he hated oboes and why did I write oboes. And after, you know, 2 or 3 weeks of this, I finally said to him, I knew I'd burned the bridge, but I said, you know, look, I'm sorry, but there aren't any oboes on the stage. There aren't any woodwinds on the stage. You know, it was one of those moments where he got so angry at me.
Those are tough moments. You know, I have to say, and I'm sure just in life in general, I can take a lot of sort of big personality, you know, I've dealt with them all. All friends of mine, actually, you know, they're all people I love. Mel Gibson and Ivan Reitman come to mind. They're very strong personalities, and that's why they're so talented, I think.
Yeah.
But I think there's a, you know, I've rarely had anybody that crosses that line. And if they do, I would, sorry that happened to you, by the way.
I've had
difficulties like that, never quite like that. But if needed, you know, I'll on a break or call a 10 and then I'll tell you one other funny story. I don't know if it's funny or not, but you know, and I'll go talk to whoever the person is, producer, director, whoever, that might be misbehaving. And then I just have a little heart to heart with them, you know, and try to figure it out. But there are times when you're just not going to win. And if somebody's behaving badly, sometimes the best thing you could do is just see ya.
Well, there's the seasoned veteran in you. You know, I certainly was not that 20 years ago, but it's, you know, you do have to understand how to deal with that kind of thing. And you're right. And particularly when there's a lot of egos in the room, both good and bad. And sometimes they're not even the filmmakers. You know, it might be the significant others of the producers. I mean, you know, we've heard those stories. And
me, you know, I try to. I don't know. Maybe it's a subtle thing. You know, I think it's how you.
Yeah.
I think when you're on the stand, and you're such a great conductor. I mean, you know this, but if I'm on a film or a TV show and I'm conducting, and let's say there's strife, there's something going on in the booth. I've just learned over the years that I can kind of power through it and work with the orchestra and get a couple takes done.
Right.
You know, and then get to your 10, get to your break. And then on the break, usually there could be a moment to discuss. But I honestly think that everybody should treat each other with respect and kindness and goodwill. And when they don't, you know, it doesn't have to mean that much. Honestly, the funny story is I had to do that one time and I didn't quit or anything like that. What I did was, I was doing a picture. I won't say the studio, but we were on the stage and the director, who was a very nice guy, we'd done 4 or 5 days of recording. We were on the very last day of recording and he hadn't given me a note. He was all week going, yeah, this is great. That's great. You know, and I love it. And then on the very last day of recording, I think in the morning, he said, oh, John, by the way, can we talk about 1M1, which is the very first piece of music in the movie?
Of course.
And he started giving me these like voluminous notes and it was, you know, it was a lot to handle and really, quite frankly, not fair of him to wait that long. He just didn't know any better,
sure,
I think.
Sure.
And so I literally, it's the first time I've ever done this and only time, I very kindly spoke to, the powers that be, and I think my agent was there. And I said, you know, guys, if you want me to, and I said it, I think very diplomatically, I told the director, I said, you know, if you'd like me to, I really need to address this, but I need to go back to my studio across the street, which is where I am now,
right.
to fix that. And I'd love to fix it, but I need time. So luckily I had a great friend of mine who was conducting, and I said, Pete, take over. And so I left, and it was so funny because I told everybody I was leaving. I said, guys, I'm not quitting. I'm just, I need to go across the street. And so I came across the street, and it took me about 5 minutes to make the change. And I just didn't go back to the studio. Next morning, the following morning, then I went in, and everybody was like, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" Yeah. And I was absolutely fine, but I had to play that one a certain way to just kind of, you know, draw a line in the sand, as it were, but a really, in a very nice way.
Sure.
I said, "Yeah, everything's great." Blah, 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 blah.
Sure.
And but it was a good lesson for me, because I realized that sometimes you just have to, you don't want to be unkind, you don't want to say anything you shouldn't, but you also have to put a line in the sand and go, you know, hey, love to do that. There's not enough time in the day. I need, you know.
Yeah.
So whenever I've had those kind of issues, it's usually pretty easily resolved with a discussion, you know. And I'm really thankful, Justin, that I've really never had to deal too much with difficult personalities. Mm-hmm. I've dealt with strong personalities, Mel being one, who I love, brilliant filmmaker, brilliant actor. But it's a process. And sometimes you need to get to know someone too.
Right.
You know? Anyway, so that's shorthand.
Well, speaking of, you know, kindness and respect, why don't we pivot to 1997's Liar Liar?
Awesome.
You know, but this, I know we had talked about this a while ago. So correct me if this is, you know, not an accurate recapitulation, but, you had mentioned that you felt that this was a film that was at the time a very big break for you, and a wonderful opportunity. And certainly Tom Shadyac, the director, an amazing director, is filled with so much talent. And the scene I wanted to share with folks, just kind of talk about it very, very quickly, is this is the first time that Jim Carrey in the courtroom has been forced to tell the truth. He, you know, it's the first time where he tried to lie and couldn't. And a reason I thought we'd share and just talk about this scene, if you wouldn't mind, is just to perhaps comment on the elephant in the room, which in every Jim Carrey movie is Jim Carrey. And he's such a comedic genius. And so there's a level of, I imagine, as the composer, sensitivity that you need to bring to the scene, you know. And I think back to, you know, some of the legendary stories we've heard of Miles Davis, you know, turning to the rhythm section and, you know, saying, you know, "I don't need any help there." You know, so what do you do as a composer? Do you help the scene? Do you stay in the background? Do you go over the top? Anyway, so this scene is what it is. And I thought it's a very light, fun, commas and periods and colons that maybe is one way to kind of...
50% of your estate.
50%? With a prenup and proof of adultery? What's your case?
Our case is simply this.
First off, I don't know how anyone on the set got through that take with any kind of serious faces, you know. But,
well, you know. That's one of my favorite films that I've done. Jim Carrey obviously is on his own plane of brilliance. And this, of course, was his, he was at the height of his powers, you know, and that was such a fun movie, because some of the musical moments and beats were really there. Most of them are dictated by Jim himself. And that one, there was something magical in that movie that it seemed like anything I would write, it would accent things. And then I realized kind of quickly while I was working on it, that the reason any music that I would right, if I got it in the right tempo, by the way, it would hit with a lot of Jim's antics. Mm. And so I think it was 50% of the time it was me trying to sort of see where I would not hit something, and other times it was hitting things right on. And Tom Shadyac is the master of comedy, really. Yeah, and yeah. So I would try things, and sometimes Tom would have me not hit something or accent after an action that Jim did. There was no science to it, other than I realized early on, Justin, that if I found the right tempo, you know, dun, 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 whatever the tempo of the scene felt like to me,
right,
then it was pretty easy to catch actions. And that doesn't happen all the time. It's also was a film that was very well cut. Don Zimmerman,
yeah,
fantastic.
Amazing. Yeah.
Brilliant editor,
yes,
who did a lot of those films. Gosh, I think I did a number of films with Don, maybe 4, 5, 6 films.
Yeah, he's a great editor.
He's a great editor. And yeah, so are his sons, by the way, the next gen. So, you know, some of that stuff was just luck of the draw. There's a great scene where Jim Carrey beats himself up in the bathroom.
Yeah, that. I do.
And once I got the tempo of sort of what he was doing and his actions and the way it was cut, things just hit well. And that's, like I said, that's not always the case. In fact,
right,
it's usually not that way. Mm-hmm. And I always feel if sometimes I'm really having a tough time accenting things, you know, for dramatic reasons, there's usually a reason behind it. Either it wasn't cut a certain way, or the performer wasn't really thinking rhythm. Jim thinks of rhythm,
right.
I think. He's always, you know, God, it still cracks me up. And he does that with his teeth. I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
But a lot of his movements in that film were fast and frenetic.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe it's a personality thing. I'm kind of, again, being the ever ready bunny, I mean, I'm always like bubbly and effervescent, I guess. And that Bruce Broughton. So, you know, I would kind of approach the music like that. And it was sort of a circus like fun time. And once I came up with a couple of ancillary themes, James Newton Howard, good friend of mine, gave me that gift. He was going to do that film, the whole film.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I told the story a million times. He had written a lovely, beautiful theme. The main theme is James's theme. And, he was going to do it, and a schedule change, and I don't know when what other picture he was going to do, but he so kindly, you know, brought me into this thing and met Shady. We met at lunch with James and Shadyac, and I think the editor,
mm-hmm,
and my friend, the music editor, Jeff Carson.
Yeah.
And J&H just, you know, put it on a platter for me.
Wow.
And he had already written a few cues, but he was like, "No, you can do this. You can do this, John. You'll kill it. It'll be great." So, you know, there are two Jameses in my life that I owe my career to. One is James Newton Howard. The other one is James Horner. And I don't know if you know that, but that's the truth. And, you know, I wouldn't have had a film career, I think, like that, as it took off, it was really because of those two Jameses, mm-hmm, you know. And I remember I used to, Newton Howard did that a couple times for me. And I used to send him little gifts and things. And one day I sent him another gift for something. And he called me, he goes, John, you don't have to send me any more gifts. You're so talented. You're doing great. Just, you know, and he's such a gracious man. Yeah. And those that know him are very lucky to know him.
Yeah. It's great to see the collaborative spirit amongst artists, which is not oftentimes seen visibly because, you know, as you know, you live this life where you live a very monk-like environment at times because you need to be in your studio and be in your mindset and be in the director's mindset, the film's mindset. And the first time I kind of heard it described as that, a monk-like environment, was actually by John Williams when I was really, really young in the late 80s. I remember seeing an interview of him. I think it was post, he had just finished The Empire Strikes Back, and he had done an interview, I think, you know, from Abbey Road. Anyway, this monk-like environment, to steal the phrase from, you know, Maestro Williams. There's a lot of that. And, you know, it probably really no other way, right? I mean, if you're trying to be myopic and narrow and deep on any subject, and whether or not it's composition or orchestration or conducting, or, you know, I'm just staying in the music vein, you need to have some of that. Sleeping under pianos, you know, when you're young and studying.
Well, you know, that's such a great, great statement and question. You know, someone asked me recently, you know, a week ago, a few days ago, like, how are you dealing with, you know, the quarantine? And I had to honestly say, fine. I'm quarantined every day.
Right.
You know, I'm lucky enough to be in this lovely room, and I have, my wife works with me, as you know, Justin, and we have a great team of people around us. I'm cloistered most of the time. I guess I'm like a monk, like you said. I'm a priest or a monk. But I'm lucky enough to do that because maybe other people are different, but I have to go really deep. And I'm sure you do when you're writing, you just lose track of time and you get into this zone and you kind of, you know, and if you're lucky like me, you just pull stuff out of the, you know, I always say I have a well, you know, like a well with water in it. And I always throw my bucket down and I always think it's going to come up empty, but for whatever reason, ideas come to me, and they come to me at all times of the day and night. And so sometimes at night, I related this story recently, you know, I'll get my iPhone out and record at 2 or 3 in the morning, some little melody that I'm looking for.
Sure.
But yeah, that is kind of the life. Now, people like our friend Hans Zimmer have found a wonderful way to have a collegial group of people that, you know, work together. And that's fantastic too.
He's an incredible collaborator.
Incredible collaborator. Yeah. Speaking of probably one of the best collaborators.
Yeah.
I just don't have that ability. He's just, he writes this wonderful music and it's so deep. And then he has other people that he collaborates with, and to great effect. So
yes, absolutely.
I'm kind of jealous. You know, I wish I could do that. I do it occasionally. You know, if I'm lucky enough to work with somebody, you know, an artist or a songwriter, Diane Warren comes to mind. She's a good friend of ours. Yeah. And, you know, she's like me. She likes to get in her cave and write, but she's just a wonderful collaborator too. So.
Brought to you by Cineconcerts.